I'd like to bring to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection for the Oregon State Legislature. It's Wednesday, March 14th, 2007. We've got public hearings on House Bill 2776, 2751, 2654, 2657, and 2659. And we will not be having work session on any of those bills except for House Bill 2751 today. At this time, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2776. Steve, can you give us a brief summary of this bill, first time in our committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2776 extends from 1 year to 5 years the authority of disadvantaged minority women or emerging small business enterprises to elect not to obtain a public works bond.
And may we have Representative Shields and Jessica Adamson, if you don't mind, since there's only two people signed up, I think we can get you both at once.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Chip Shields, State Representative, District 43, North and Northeast Portland. This bill is a pretty simple improvement on Senate Bill 477B, the prevailing wage bill, from last session. I have constituent Sharon Maxwell Hendricks, who is the owner of a construction company called Bonergis Construction. They've got about 20 employees. They're union employer, plumbers local 290, union iron workers, union painters. And during the interim, she brought some concerns with me from that bill, because you may recall Senate Bill 477 had an exemption from the prevailing wage bond for women, minority, and emerging small businesses for 1 year. And that 1 year was actually from the date that they were certified as a minority, women owner, emerging small business. And so we rolled up our sleeves, and I had brought together actually the various minority chambers of commerce during the interim, the Hispanic Chamber, or members of the Hispanic Chamber, members of ONABIN, the Oregon Native American Business Investment Network, I believe, and the Oregon Association of Minority Entrepreneurs, and we really wanted to put together a minority business agenda. Now, they decided to make House Bill 2776 part of that agenda, and this became one of the group's priority bills. And so the original of the bill says we'll take that one-year exemption and just extend it out to 5 years so that developing businesses would have more of a chance to avoid that bond, which can, you know, sometimes be $900 or $1,000. And because frequently what happens is somebody might get certified, but they might not get their first government contract for 2 or 3 years into their business life. So we started off with that, and I thought that some people involved in the construction industry might have a view about that bill, and I'm very pleased that Associated General Contractors sat down with us and said, well, look, maybe we can work out a compromise that helps everybody's needs. And so we have created a Dash 1 amendment that would, kind of the compromise solution we agreed on was going from 1 year to three. And actually, maybe I could just have Jessica, do you want to explain the amendment and what the effect would be?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Associated General Contractors. And if I can take just a moment and explain why this requirement came into effect in the first place, it might help inform the discussion here. Prior to Senate Bill 477, the ORS 279C, the Public Contracting Code, requires that public agencies get essentially a 200% bond from general contractors prior to, as part of the construction process. And that bond covers, or those two bonds cover two different things. The first is performance, and a performance bond guarantees that if a contractor goes south, if a contractor disappears in the middle of the project, God heaven forbid, the agency is protected, and that bond will step in and make sure that the agency can complete that project with another contractor and repays them for those damages. So it protects the performance of the contract. But the second bond is really what this bill kind of started to get at, which is the payment side of it. And that protects the subcontractors and the workers on that project. So in the event that they don't get paid properly or at all, the payment bond is there for folks to file against and is there to make those folks whole in the event that there are issues. So in the past, the project may come to a close, and there's a period of time after the project is complete in which workers have an opportunity to file a claim with the Bureau of Labor and Industries and say, I wasn't paid prevailing wage, or I wasn't paid the right amount of prevailing wage, or whatever claim that might be. And at that point in time, the Bureau attaches to that general contractor's bond. That's what they have. That is their vehicle to guarantee that that gets paid. Now, those workers that may claim that they have a wage issue, those might not be the workers of the general contractor. It may be the workers of a subcontractor or a second-tier subcontractor, somebody that the general contractor didn't have a direct relationship with. Everyone on the job is required to pay prevailing wage, but up until now, for the most part, the only one on the job with a payment bond was a general contractor. So at the end of the day, though everyone is required to pay prevailing wage, and the general contractor has a right of action against the sub to try and recover those wages, the reality is the one on the hook is the general contractor. At the end of the day, it's the general contractor that the buck stops there. And from a public policy standpoint, we could, in some senses, understand that at some level you need protection for those workers. However, from a fairness standpoint, it had been troublesome to the general contractors for some time that at the end of the day, if a sub, who we may not know what classification of worker they are or how many hours they really work, that's between the subcontractor employee and the subcontractor. If there was an error made there, the only one holding the bag was a general contractor, and that just fundamentally seemed unfair. So last session, as a part of a major package on prevailing wage, we said instead of trying to get everyone to post a performance and payment bond up and down the line on every project, in part because of the expense, in part because it's just not practical, let's go to a scenario where everyone posts with that wants to do public work, everyone posts a payment bond with the Construction Contractors Board. And that payment bond will be available to the Bureau of Labor and Industries to attach to first in the event of a wage claim. So if you have a project where a subcontractor doesn't pay the correct amount of wages, or there is a claim that he or she didn't pay the correct amount of wages, and that worker files a claim with the Bureau of Labor and Industries, the Bureau would then go and attach up to $30,000, which is the size of the bond, against that subcontractor's bond first, and then go to the project-specific bond that the general has and attach the remainder to that. So that way, everyone shares more responsibility in making sure the appropriate wages are paid. Everyone has skin in the game. Everyone has a bond on the line to make sure that we are as accurate as humanly possible in making sure those wages are paid. So that gives you the background for why we pursued this in the first place. As it got implemented, we did give the one-year exemption because sometimes getting bonding capacity can be an issue for emerging small businesses, and we recognize that. As we heard throughout the interim, there were concerns that 1 year wasn't long enough. My board debated that issue and said we can go to a three-year timeline. By then, most folks are kind of up and running. They've got financials in place. They should have some security behind them. Their business plan should be, by that point in time, should be relatively clear, and they should be able to get the money together and the meet the standards for underwriting to get a $30,000 bond if they're going to play in the public marketplace. So by that time, they should be able to do that. Additionally, we had heard some concerns about smaller projects, those typically under $100,000, where really the labor portion of those projects is relatively small. And so you'd be buying a public works bond, especially concerns in the rural community about, well, we've got a school district who's installing a $75,000 HVAC system, air conditioning system, and the labor portion of that's going to be $2,000 or $3,000, and the subcontractor needs to purchase a public works bond for the one public works project they're going to do all year. It just didn't seem quite fair. So we said, okay, let's look at 100 projects under $100,000. Let's just exempt those all together from public works bonds. So that's what the Dash 1 amendment does. It raises that exemption period to 3 years, and it also exempts all projects under $100,000 from having to have that public works bond. It's our feeling that may gives a little more flexibility to the law. And again, gets at that whole concept that when you have projects where you're required to have a performance and payment bond in place, everyone up and down the line should share in the responsibility to make sure workers get paid prevailing wage. It shouldn't just follow the general contractor to be on the hook with their bonding capacity. Everyone should share in that responsibility. The reason why we picked the $30,000 number wasn't by accident. We worked with Boley, who went back and looked and said at the end of the day, most of these claims, the majority of them, settled out for $30,000 or less. So that seemed like a good number to peg it at and say this is going to cover most of those claims. It's not going to cover all of them, but it's a step in the right direction to help see if we can't reduce claims by making more folks responsible with assets on the line to make sure that they, as much as possible, prevailing wage is very complicated, but as much as possible, get it right the first time.
Thank you, Jessica. I got to commend you. You do such a thorough job of explaining the history and explaining the total context of the bill as it relates back to 477. I guess I've got to bring this up because I think there might be an issue because you just raised it in your delivery of the total project price of $100,000, and in my discussions with Representative Shields earlier, he was thinking the contract price being the subcontractor's bid on that project and not really the total project price. And I think I might, if I'm, you know, did I misunderstand that? Because I think we're talking about two different prices.
Yeah, if I could, Mr. Chair, we just got the amendments at about 11, and as someone who doesn't know a whole lot about the construction business, frankly, I was trying to scramble to make sure I understood what they meant. I think probably at this point I'll need to go back to Sharon Maxwell Hendricks, just make sure she understands, make sure that the minority chambers understand that the actual threshold would be $100,000.
And I might ask Jessica a question, because normally I think I'm familiar with PWR statutes very rarely talk about subcontract amounts. And so I don't know, you know, maybe you can work with Representative Shields and see if there's something that works there. I'm not exactly positive that I'm sure anything can be done, but I'm not sure how consistent that is with the rest of our 279 chapter.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the statute very rarely, and in fact in only one area, really refers to the subcontract amounts, and that's within the context of reporting, and those are very major contracts. But I can tell you that a subcontract for $100,000, that isn't an insignificant subcontract. That's a pretty substantial piece of business. And so I think as we look at the different figures in statute, you have a public works contract if you're involving funds of a public agency and some other criteria above $50,000. There is a $100,000 threshold now that deals with the ability of a public agency to do a competitive quote. So it's more formal process under that threshold, and they can go out and solicit on a more informal process those kinds of projects. So in thinking about about this. It seemed that if you're doing an informal process, which most of the contracts under that threshold are, that it was more appropriate to say that those contracts shouldn't be subject to this requirement. Additionally, there's another bill that we hope will be coming over from the Senate soon that deals with projects funded by the Emerging Small Business Account, and that will raise that threshold for those projects from $50,000 to $100,000. So there'll be a variety of thresholds at $100,000. So we felt that this would tie in nicely to what is already becoming, it seems, a pretty common number. We're happy to work with Representative Shields and see if this will meet that test. I think at this point in time, my board has said 100 projects total value under $100,000. That's a very different scope than looking at all subcontracts under $100,000. That's just a very different ball game. So we look forward to continuing to work with the representative on this issue. We appreciate the concerns of the minority community, and we want to try and, again, alleviate those to the best we can. Again, maintaining the policy that when you're in the public works arena and you are required to pay prevailing wages, we feel it's really important that that everyone shares in that opportunity and responsibility.
Questions? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to echo our chair's comments about the thoroughness of your testimony, Ms. Adamson. I have a question, because when you were explaining the history, because I, for one, was not here in the last session, so I really appreciate the background. You were talking about the payment bond existing to protect subcontractors and other workers, and I wonder if has history since that passed has shown that most of the claims are made on projects that are above $100,000 or below $100,000. My concern is that if the payment bond is to protect the subcontractors and other workers, and we're talking about getting rid of it on all projects that are lower than $100,000, are we getting rid of a remedy that's been used frequently, or are most of the claims made in projects of a larger amount?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, because this public works bond first came into effect for projects advertised on or after July 1, 2006. Yes, that would be correct. Sorry, trying to do the math backwards. We really don't have a real rich history on claims against these bonds. It's really relatively rather new, and projects of a particular length. The Bureau, I'm not sure, is here, but they could give you a better sense of how many claims. This doesn't remove the public works bond. Only is there as a remedy for prevailing wage claims. So the payment bond, the public works bond, will not be an avenue for subcontractors to obtain remedy for payment through that bond. It's only the only one that can attach to the bond is the Bureau, and it can only attach to that bond for purposes of payment of prevailing wage. In the instance where you've got a project under $100,000, the general contractor is still going to be required to have their public works performance and payment bonds in place. So in the event that there is a dispute on a project under $100,000, that general contractor's project specific bond will still be in play and available to attach for those purposes. From a protection of the workers, protection of the subcontractor, protection of the owner standpoint, we won't lose anything there. It just won't. Not all subcontractors will have that performance, the public works bond in place and available for those workers. The reality is, when you have a project under $100,000, you're probably looking at 50 to 60% of that project cost being in materials, maybe more. So you're looking at a relatively low dollar threshold in which you've got liability for payment of those wages. So a claim would be relatively small if it were to come, and I think the general contracting community is willing to accept that risk because the number of claims on a project of that size are going to be relatively low. And what happens when a general contractor's per project bond is attached, if you think about a general contractor, we have relationships with surety companies. And because all of these public works projects require us to have a full performance and payment bond, we spend a lot of time with those companies working on underwriting to determine what our financial capability is. And so they say, okay, you're a company, we'll give you up to $1 million in bonding capacity, or $50 million, or $100 million, whatever number they feel like you've got enough assets to stand behind what your financials are. So if you have a bond that gets held up or gets attached by BOLI, you think about your bonding capacity as a string. What that does is the bonding company says, this portion over here that's being held by BOLI, you can't go bid another project in which you would expect to use that bonding capacity because it's being held over here. So if we have claims because of a subcontractor down the line, that has an impact on our ability to go out and bid more work. But if you're talking a project under $100,000, the liability against your overall bonding capacity is going to be relatively minor, and we're willing to accept that risk, which is why we're willing to say we're comfortable exempting those projects.
Thank you very much.
Thank
Sorry
you.
For a long-winded answer.
And, you know, I'm going to go ahead and close this public hearing because I have a feeling we'll be back reviewing this bill yet again. In the interest of time, I've got some other bills that I really need to tend to. Representative Shields, comment?
A closing comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you for this. And I really want to commend AGC for stepping up to work on a compromise here. It's showed a lot of good faith, and we really appreciate it. Also, one of the reasons, in addition to going back to the minority chambers, that I want to do some due diligence on is I really want to make sure that there are enough $100,000 and below projects out there that this would actually have that kind of impact. And I'll check with BOLI and others and Jessica and her members to just make me feel more comfortable with that.
I appreciate that, and hopefully you can come to an agreement on what the amount should be. Thanks a lot for bringing this forward. I think this is a needed bill out there, so hope we can figure something out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's right.
With that, I close the public hearing on House Bill 2776 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2751. Steve, give us a little preview of House Bill 2751, please.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. House Bill 2751 permits insurer to issue liability insurance at a preferred rate or premium to construction contractors without violating the prohibition against fictitious groupings, and there is a Dashrone amendment before the members.
There it is. Does anybody from DCBS on insurance like to give us a couple comments on this bill, perhaps? Or CCB, if you wish. It doesn't matter. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Ariel. I'm the administrator with the Insurance Division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. This bill was up once before, and I don't believe there was any objection to it. The reason there's an amendment today is because the way in which we define the type of insurance in this bill was not technically as accurate as it could have been, and so the new amendment more clearly specifies what we're talking about here in terms of contractor liability insurance. So it's just a technical amendment to better define the term. To step back, the larger purpose of this bill is simply to allow contractors in a situation where multiple contractors are going to work on the same project for some period of time to purchase a group policy for that purpose. Under current insurance law, that can be difficult to do because of certain regulations that we have about group policies. And so what this bill does is to exempt that situation in the contractor situation, exempts that from those regulatory requirements in the same way that we've exempted a number of other common situations from those regulations. And that's all the bill really does. It would just make it easier for contractors to purchase that kind of group policy in certain circumstances.
Thank you. We've heard this bill before, and does the committee have any questions they'd like to make?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Bonamici.
I'd like to move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill. Oh, we're still in public hearing. Sorry, I have to wait for you to gavel.
So, no comments, questions?
Yes, sir.
Representative Nelson?
Yes, if I could please. I just want to ask, what does this mean, fictitious groupings?
As I recall, Mr. Ario had a good description of it last time, so I'll allow him to do that again.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, in the property and casualty side of insurance, there's concern that if a group of people, it goes back to days where there was racial profiling, that sort of thing, that if you allowed people to group up and then get insurance on a group basis, that group may then get benefits that aren't fairly attributable to the group at the expense of everybody who's not part of the group. So it was fictitious group laws are to prevent people from forming groups that don't really serve an insurance purpose. And they require you to go through a set of hoops to demonstrate that there really is a valid insurance purpose for putting the group together. And that's still necessary in certain circumstances. But with these kind of projects, we looked at it and said these are the same as some other exemptions where there isn't any real concern that somehow this group is disadvantaging everybody else. And so we just cut through the red tape and say this kind of group can be exempted from those statutes.
Thank you for that, Mr. Ario. Seeing no further question, I appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you.
I see no one else signed up for House Bill 2751, and I know there are some insurance industry and construction contractor groups in the room. If anyone wishes to make a comment on it, everybody seems to be fine. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2751 and open a work session on House Bill 2751. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2751.
Representative Bonamici moves the committee adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2751. Any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, the Dash 1 amendments are adopted. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we send House Bill 2751 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that it be placed on the consent calendar.
Representative Bonamici moves House Bill 2751 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that it be placed on the consent calendar. Hannah, could you call the roll?
Aye.
And for the record, we are putting that on the consent calendar. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2751 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2654. Steve, would you give us a preview of House Bill 2654?
Thank you, Chair Hovey. House Bill 2654 requires construction contractors to maintain insurance that provides the contractor with liability coverage for completed work.
Thank you. I believe this was one of the task force recommendations. Is somebody from the task force, insurance industry, or construction contractors board, you could all come up and talk to us if you wish.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Joel Ariel from the Insurance Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. This is a so-called completed operations bill, which, again, most people in the state thought that their insurance requirement that CCB has, which requires contractors to have insurance in order to be in the business, required them to have completed operations coverage, not just so-called work-in-progress coverage. The difference is the work-in-progress is, as it sounds like, just covers you while you're actually doing the construction. Completed operations covers you for the 10-year period of repose after construction is completed. a couple of years ago, the AG ruled that the statute requiring insurance could be met by simply having work-in-progress insurance. So this bill was considered, but this issue was considered by the task force, and it was decided that we ought to put in law the requirement that most contractors do meet, and that everybody has again assumed was what was meant by the insurance coverage, and that is to require completed operations coverage. So that's what this bill does. The reason it's back in front of you today is that there were technical concerns about the way the bill was worded and how the words completed operations, which is a term of art that's not defined in the statutes, might be interpreted by the courts. And so you have some defining language around the concept. So it now reads, under the Dash 2 amendments, products and completed operations according to the terms of the policy and subject to applicable policy exclusions. So we believe that takes care of the issues around defining the coverage here properly. I understand that there may be people who still have concerns about whether there's a comma missing in the definition that somehow has an impact on the definition. We don't have those concerns, but you may hear them from others.
Chair Helvey and members of the committee, Craig Smith with the Construction Contractors Board. I come to the desk just at the request of the chair to answer questions. I've not been active in this bill other than to the extent following through the task force. It was an important issue that the task force addressed, and it's my understanding that the bill has the support of most people involved.
Thank you for that. Any questions of these gentlemen from the committee? Thanks a lot for your testimony. Is there anybody else that would like to testify to House Bill 2654, including Scott Berry?
Mr. Chair, Brian Doherty. I'm here today testifying on behalf of Contractors Bonding and Insurance Corporation. We did ask for some of these amendments that have just come back, and I am the one that's maybe down to just a comma before we're just fine with this bill, and it had to do with how these things apply to each other, whether they just apply to one or not another. I've also talked to many of you and scheduled to talk to others of you about an idea about a package of bills, and this is one that's included that we hope to bring to you as something where we have a buy-off from a substantial number of the stakeholders in this industry. We hope that what we could do is bring this back. As I'll just tell you today, as we walked into the hearing, we got another amendment that was to one of these bills that was since the email we got yesterday with amendments. So we're trying to find out and read these and make sure we got it. But there's a package, I think, that is a very good place for us to start. And we're just trying to get to look at all these amendments and get buy-off from our companies in order to go forward. And I hope that you consider that so that we could present something to you shortly.
Yes, I appreciate that, and it is not my intention to move this bill today or any others left on the agenda, because we've just gotten those amendments too and haven't really had time to study them to the degree that we should and check back with everybody that's concerned about these as well. So thank you for your comments. Questions of Representative Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you read Eats, Shoots, and Leaves? I'm trying to figure out where the comma is that's the issue here.
Or may not be.
Where is the, is it a comma that's there that shouldn't be, or a comma that's allegedly missing that should be there?
Chair Holby, Representative Bonamici, there was in a prior iteration, there was not a comma there that might lead you to believe that the exclusions could only apply to the completed ops or just to a portion of a policy, not to other portions of the policy. And in fact, in real world, they apply all. And so it was a issue that CBIC's general counsel raised to us, and I have not had a chance to be able to go back and say, there's a comma here, has this worked for you? So it was just a matter of whether it could be interpreted in the wrong way, that even the insurance division would not intend it to be done so.
Are you talking about on line 7, page 1?
The 26-4, the dash amendment I have here is not the one that we're dealing with. I apologize for not having it here. But
right.
I'd be glad to bring that to you and show you what we're talking about. And it may be that it's fine now.
Grammatical curiosity.
That's a good question. In any respect, Mr. Berry, would you wish to give us some testimony?
Yeah, Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders Association, and I just wanted to come up on House Bill 2654 for the most part to have a bill today that I was going to testify in favor of. So we are supportive of House Bill 2654. We've just gotten amendments to the other bills that are up today, so it's difficult to comment, but we are in favor of House Bill 2654, and I'm sure we'll be fine with a comma being there or not being there, whatever the case may be.
And it does appear that we're considering the dash two amendments on this bill, so that we've taken some of those recommendations that have come forward. So for the committee's information, it does look like the dash twos will be the ones we move with. Appreciate your testimony. Any questions from the committee of these two gentlemen? Thanks a lot for your input and your testimony today. Anyone else wanting to testify on House Bill 2654? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2654 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2657. Steve, would you give us a brief description of House Bill 2657?
Thank you, Chair Holvey. House Bill 2657 requires a contractor undertaking residential construction or improvement work on residential structure to provide property owner with a written contract.
Thank you. And is this a task force? Could we have... perhaps the Construction Contractors Board and Department of Consumer Business Services, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long, staff to the Construction Claims Task Force, and 2657 is a bill that was recommended by the Construction Claims Task Force. What I'm here to do... to do today or this afternoon is just really provide you a progress update since the last hearing regarding this bill. We've been, both the board and the division and others have been working together to rough out or smooth out some of the rough edges with the bill as it was originally drafted. And what I'm providing to the committee, and I've provided to the individuals in the room that we've been working with, the latest version of our language. We do not have all of the commas, periods, capitalization, and other pieces of the work worked out as yet, but we are making progress on bringing a bill to you that essentially will encompass what the task force recommended. What I'd like to do, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair, is just kind of talk to you about what we're trying to do at a in 2657 and talk about, to the extent you have questions, what's different between the bill that was heard, I think it was about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and where we're at today.
Yeah, that'd be fine.
Okay. Mr. Chair, what we're trying to do with 2657 is address some of the issues around notification to consumers, construction liens, and other matters. So if you look at the very draft language that you now have a copy of, in Section 2, we're trying to prohibit a contractor from claiming a lien if the contractor needed a written contract and did not have one. Section 4 of the bill gets at the certificate of occupancy and consistency of permit forms and processes. This is an important piece to tag along with the construction claims task force recommendations. Felt that it was necessary to have a standardized CFO for all jurisdictions. That's kind of a final document a building department provides to a contractor before occupancy, and then making sure that the forms and procedures for contractors applying for permits and any of the sign-off documents are standardized across the 132 jurisdictions that are out there on a statewide basis. Section 6 of the bill gives an owner 1 business day to review the information in the contract and provides an out. I think that's, we've talked about that before. There were problems in the, as the original bill was drafted. Section 7 requires the contractor to send the information notice on liens, allows them to be a first-class mail, and they need to keep that notice. Section 9 requires the signatures for those notices. Section 10 requires signature line on the information notice, so there's multiple notices. Section 12 requires them to keep evidence, and if it's determined by the CCB that you didn't provide the notice to the consumer under Section 13, the time would be extended to the consumer to file a complaint. Currently, I believe it's 1 year. Is that correct,
Craig?
And what we were recommending, that if the consumers weren't given adequate notification and we couldn't demonstrate that they received that notification, that they indeed would get an extra year to file a complaint under the CCB process and allow the board to resolve that dispute. That's 2657 kind of in a nutshell. We also just provided an overview. Another document, Mr. Chair, again, is a status update. What's different between the bill as drafted and what we've provided here and kind of the staff working document? The document I just went through, again, is something that we're circulating with the various interest groups, attempting to work through the commas, periods, capitalization, as well as the policy issues that are in there, and we're getting close. And with that, I don't know, Craig, if you want to add anything, we'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Craig, do you have any comments?
Chair Holby, members of the committee, Craig Smith, Construction Contractors Board. I just add that the, again, these are the task force recommendations. They continue to go through the process of vetting with the various interest groups, and I think that by the end of the day, there'll be some commonality in terms of what can be offered to you, and there'll be improvements to the regulatory process. Of course, I'm here mostly to answer questions. Thank you.
Let me start out with a question. I know we had two related bills, House Bill 2110 and House Bill 2120, that dealt with notification pieces and whatnot. Are those bills now being incorporated in the conceptual proposed amendments to this bill?
Chair Holby, I would say, again, Craig Smith, I would say that they are. They've had to do some remodeling of those bills to fit them in. Of course, there's one thing that was taken out to try to make it more palatable for all, and that has to do with the rebuttable presumption of what would happen if they didn't have evidence of the document. But I can tell you that the lion's share of what was in the bill is now in House Bill 2657.
So do you care to explain to the committee the rebuttal of presumption and why we decided to take that out? Was that just a consensus among the work group, and what does that do in your opinion?
Chair Holby, I was not in the work group where it was taken out. But I can tell you that that is a legal term. It would help with the administration from the state's standpoint. But and I wasn't there, so I don't want to comment on the maturations as to why it was taken out. And as I lose my voice, which some would say is a tragedy and others would say is a blessing, I'll pass this over to Mark.
To lose my voice or Chair Holby, Mark Long again. The issue is, if I recall correctly, under one of those bills, and I don't remember which one it is off the top of my head, whether it's 2110 or 2120, it would require the contractor to provide notice to the consumers and require the contractor to keep that notice, a copy of that signed notice. And if they couldn't present a copy of that signed notice at whichever time the board asked them to, they were presumed to have not given that to the consumer. The contractors expressed some concern with that just from record keeping and how to manage that, and suggest that the absence of keeping the document in the file does not necessarily indicate that it wasn't provided to the consumer. And so what we did is kind of the middle of the road, asked the contractors that they do, we indicate in this draft that they do need to keep the document. They need to demonstrate some type of evidence that they've kept the document or that they provided the document to the consumer. Some contractors use a kind of a final sign-off sheet, and you can say, or they use a upfront disclosure sheet where you can check off, yes, I did get the forms. And then we also gave the CCB board authority to write rules to address this issue. And I think the main thing from the contractor's perspective and in looking at this is whether or not there is a pattern of a contractor not providing these notices or whether this was an isolated situation where a file was not kept and couldn't demonstrate that document. It gives the board the discretion to make that decision, and the outcome of that decision is that the consumer gets an extra year to file a claim with the Construction Contractors Board. Answer your question.
So do you think that the CCB has the adequate tools then to determine whether or not the notice was given?
Chair Holvey, I would agree with Craig that the presumption, what's the other standard?
Rebuttable presumption.
Rebuttable presumption is a clearer standard and a better standard for the board. However, we were not able to get consensus on that item.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Seems pretty quiet. Thank you for your testimony. And at that point, we'll wait to hear some more discussion.
Thank you.
I know we just have heard the agency speak on this bill, and the amendments are very fresh, and people really probably haven't had much time to go over them. But if there's anybody else that wishes to make comments about this bill, you're welcome to do so at this time. Seeing none, I guess everybody's okay with them? Or,
okay? Okay, you're not okay, I take it.
The records show that there are several heads nodding now.
Okay, well, everybody needs more time to look at them, I'm assuming, yes. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I just want to point out that looking at my notes from when we had the hearing on this bill, there was some issue about the $2,000 limit. Because under current law, there's a requirement of a written contract if it's $2,000 or more. And there was some discussion in the hearing about whether this was intended to change that, and I think that it does, but I'm not sure that that's an issue that everybody was comfortable with. So hopefully that'll get worked out. Oh, I see, Mr. Long.
We did. Mark Long for the record.
I have that in my notes too.
Yeah, we did bring the. We took that provision out of the bill as drafted and brought it back to existing law, which I believe is $2,000 for a written contract. So we are, in what we've proposed here today as the work in progress that's in front of you, it refers back to the current law of $2,000 for a written contract. And just so that you know, Mr. Chair, I probably send you the wrong impression. There is not necessarily consensus on every particular piece that's contained in this working document that's in front of you. But it's our best effort to meet the needs of what the task force recommended as well as the concerns of the stakeholders, and there will probably continue to be some disagreements over particular pieces.
Well, I appreciate that. I know it's a big task, and I appreciate your testimony and your work. Thank you. So seeing no further questions and no one else wanting to talk at this time, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2657 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2659. Steve, give us a brief review of 2659.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. House Bill 2659 allows the Construction Contractors Board to investigate financial and criminal history of the applicant for licensing.
Thank you. And we have Craig Smith and Mark Long back to give us a rendition of this particular bill. And if you'd identify yourself once again for the record, I'd appreciate it.
Sure, Chair Holvey. For the record, Mark Long with Department of Consumer and Business Services, staff of the Construction Claim Task Force. Again, this is another progress report, if you will, on House Bill 2659, which is the series of recommendations to the task force encompassing expanded authority for the Construction Contractors Board for its enforcement powers. If you look at the draft that we provided, I can walk through and tell you what we're attempting to accomplish. I think I give you the same comments that I gave you earlier. We've attempted to work out most of the concerns. However, there are still some items in here that probably do not have full support of all the parties. In Section 2, we are recommending expanding the powers of the Construction Contractors Board to investigate license applicants. And this primarily is looking back, I believe, up to 5 years into past financial matters so that the board can get a sense of the history of a contractor. That particular section, I feel confident is going to have some disagreement, and we're continuing to kind of work on that. Section 3 expands information that must be disclosed to CCB when applying for a license. We think that that's important so that the CCB, again, can look back into past actions to determine whether or not the contractor should qualify for a license. In Sections 4 and 5, we expand the basis for suspension and the ability to refuse a license. We think that that's important. And specifically in Section 5, we add to the areas for emergency suspension under the Construction Contractors Board for unpaid debt, and one other item that escapes me right now at the top of my head. And then the last part of Section 6 of this bill, it adds to the Class A misdemeanor range of sanctions that CCB currently has. And just to bring the committee up to speed, the board currently has authority to it is a Class A misdemeanor, as I recall, Craig, when we went through this, for failure to have a license when you should have a license, or using someone else's license inappropriately. Is that correct? And this would expand and add another category, and that would be if a contractor had unpaid debt after an order from the Construction Contractors Board, kind of make that a higher threshold action. The parts that were removed from the bill received some testimony last time at the hearing were the criminal citation authority pieces for the board. Felt that that was probably something from a liability standpoint and just from a practical standpoint. It was the task force had recommended that, but it was difficult to figure out all those elements, so that's been taken out. You may recall a great deal of discussion around shoddy construction and attempting to define shoddy construction and making that a criminal act. Could not get the periods and commas lined up in dealing with that, so that has been removed out of the bill. And we've attempted to address many of the other issues. So, again, progress report to you. It's my hope to bring you back something in actual dash amendments that will have support from the stakeholders, but also meet the recommendations of the Construction Claims Task Force. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Chair Holvey's members of the committee, Craig Smith, Construction Contractors Board. Again, of course, the task force bill, this does not contain any of the Construction Contractors Board's pre-session filed bills that I can point out at this point. These are ideas that came from the task force that have been honed down to items that provide additional tools for the regulator. You need to appreciate, of course, as I'm sure you do, that this is a balancing act between individual rights and rights that you give to regulators to try to protect citizens, in the case Construction Contractors Board and consumers. So what I can tell you is these are policy decisions that will be before you, and we're here to carry out those policies once you decide what those shall be, and we're working with Mark and the folks from DCBS as best we can to help you bring something that will work. Here to answer questions for you.
Thank you, for your testimony. Questions? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick one. Can you give me an example of appropriate use of someone else's license?
Appropriate use.
You can do an inappropriate use, I assume.
Yeah. Chair Hovey and Representative Riley, you give me food for thought. An appropriate use of somebody else's license is probably a good point. Can't think of an appropriate use of somebody else's license. Of course, what we're talking about here is situations where a person with, or in some cases without, the knowledge of a contractor uses that contractor's license to purchase materials or allegedly under its auspices to produce construction work, and of course that's wrong, whether it's with permission or without permission, and of course it's something that we see from time to time, and it drives construction contractors crazy as well as consumers to despair.
So the word inappropriate is inappropriate, is it?
I'll leave that, Chair Hovey and Representative Riley, for the wordsmiths.
Thank you. Further questions, Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Long, Mr. Smith, in Section 6, when you noted that there's a, in this, for discussion purposes only draft, a section that would make an unpaid construction debt a Class A misdemeanor, a red flag went up. Because the other acts in that section involve some sort of intentional misuse of a license or using a contractor's license without authorization with intent to deceive. But am I missing something from that section, or are we criminalizing an unpaid debt, which is a huge policy decision?
Chair Holby, Representative Bonamici, again, the task force recommended that we explore additional items that would rise to a Class A misdemeanor violation. And frankly, in some of the earlier drafts, there were items such as not having a bond, not having insurance. That seems to be problematic from an implementation standpoint, because if you had lapsed for a day or two, I don't know that that rises to that level. So in working with members of the task force and staff, the idea here is, and what we've heard through testimony at the task force, is that the contractor will be ordered to satisfy debt to a consumer. CCB will provide that order. They will revoke or suspend or take some other civil action against the contractor, but the debt doesn't get paid to the consumer. The question is, what happens at that point? And looking at this, this might be kind of problematic in the way that it's drafted, but the issue is what happens to the contractor that has a judgment from, judgment's the wrong word, has an order from CCB, and CCB's taken all of its civil authority. What's the next step for trying to address that problem? And there was at least one, if not two or three examples that were brought to the task force where it appeared particular individuals were not, that the actions of the CCB didn't get their attention enough, I guess. And so the question is, how do you rise the bar? And I hope I've answered your question. That's the issue behind it. That's the issue behind.
I think I'd be a lot more comfortable with some language that had to do with, for example, and I'm just kind of thinking out loud here, which is kind of dangerous. Something like an intentional failure to comply with an order after directed by the CCB, or something that had some sort of intentional criminal behavior before we start. Because it looks like we're criminalizing an unpaid debt, which I'm really skeptical about the wisdom of doing, since we have an entire process set up in law to collect unpaid debts that doesn't involve criminalizing the debt.
Chair Holby, Representative Bonamici, I think I understand your concerns.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Thank you again. And we have somebody signed up to speak on this bill, Jessica Adamson. Anybody else wishing to speak? Oh, the hands are going up.
It's in that little red packet.
Come on up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with AGC. And may I first start by saying we appreciate what's trying to be done here, and believe me, my board members and members of my association are constantly frustrated by folks who end up in the paper giving the industry a bad name. And to the extent that we can work together to find a bill and a way to keep those folks out of the industry or from re-entering the industry once they're out, we are in support of that, because what we don't want to see are folks who are bad actors acting that way towards consumers of any kind in Oregon. That said, I just want to say that we remain committed to continuing to work on this legislation, but this draft, I want to raise a few more concerns. First, we share the concern of Representative Bonamici and appreciate her raising that. That is our concern as well. Additionally, when we're looking at items 1, 2, and 3 on page 1, and they are, again, reiterated on page three and four of the bill as it relates to individuals, we're concerned that when we're talking about issuance of judgments or arbitration awards that remain unpaid, again, some of these actions happen as a matter of trying to resolve disputes and legitimate construction disputes, certainly on the commercial side of the industry. You go to arbitration, you work something out, you get an award, and you pay that award. And it's a question of that those could be a few days old. They could be in process. This doesn't say, hey, you've had it for 45 or 60 days and you still aren't paying it. So at a minimum, we would encourage looking at it at a time frame there, because there is after a certain period of time, you aren't paying it. But if it's less than 30 days old, you're processing the check. So that there is a whole issue there. Sometimes you've got an award against you, you're working with your insurer to get that paid because that's their opportunity to step up and pay it. Again, we want to look at language that works and doesn't penalize people that are going through a normal litigation process or arbitration process, which is set out in our contract. So not all of those awards are the same or represent wrongdoing. Additionally, this language still appears to involve individuals who may declare bankruptcy or go insolvent for personal reasons, and that has us concerned. You may go bankrupt for many reasons, including folks who don't have who find high medical bills or divorce or some other reason that may have absolutely nothing to do with your business life, and the fact that you've had a personal bankruptcy may or may not have any bearing on your ability to conduct business in this state or have a business. And so we'd be concerned about the unintended consequences, especially when you have many corporate shareholders or folks with controlling interests who have personal lives quite separate and apart from their business. And we'd also say that, though we understand what you're trying to get to in bankruptcy, and certainly there are cases where folks go bankrupt to avoid their responsibilities. But not all bankruptcies are the same. They're not all equal. There are different, that's why there's in Chapter 11 and Chapter 13, there are different requirements, there are different structures. Sometimes you're trying to restructure your company in order to get back out of bankruptcy, and so you're working with your creditors, setting up a different timeline. Not all bankruptcies are the same, and they don't necessarily mean the same thing as it relates to your business activity. So we would just caution and share that information with the committee, again, with the idea that we don't want folks who are going into business, racking up debt, walking away from that debt, declaring bankruptcy, leaving people in the lurch, and then reforming under a new company and coming back in. We don't support that. We're not trying to protect that. We just are trying to say that in some instances, by saying all folks who we want you to report all bankruptcy and all insolvency, and we want to hold that as a possible way of keeping folks out, well, there may be unintended consequences there, and so we just want to be really careful as we craft this legislation not to have unintended consequences that we don't believe this committee intends to impart on the industry. Again, we remain very committed to continue to work with the Building Codes Division, with the CCB, to find a way to implement what the task force was trying to get at, which is we want to keep the folks that are bad actors out of this industry, and we agree with that very strongly. We just have some remaining concerns about the practicality of the business world and what it means against what's written on this page.
Thank you. I just have one question, Jessica. Do you think, that your organization is just not comfortable talking about
bankruptcies in general as far as having those reportable. What about a bankruptcy of a person who was engaged in the construction contracting business when they declared bankruptcy and left unpaid construction contract debts? If you were to clarify a person that declares bankruptcy while engaged in construction, while they were in the business of construction, and actually left unpaid construction contract debts as a result of that bankruptcy, would that still be something that you think you wouldn't support?
Mr. Chair, let me clarify AGC's position, because I didn't mean to imply that we don't support or aren't willing to discuss the idea of bankruptcy in any case. I think we're just concerned about the very broad implication that's here. I think that is something that the scenario you just talked about, I think that's something that we would be willing to look at and see if we can't get to a way of talking about that in the context of reporting that kind of a bankruptcy to the CCB and what that would mean to consumers. I think that would be something that my folks would be willing to get there on and not have the kind of concern that we have just about a broad ability to deny somebody a license solely because they had a bankruptcy that had nothing to do with their construction activity. So the short answer is yes, we'd be willing to. Sorry.
next testimony, and then Mr. Kafouri.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafouri. I'm here representing the Oregon Remodelers Association. I want to basically second Jessica's testimony. I think if a person came to this room without much background, they could see a scenario that looks like problems in the community with bad contractors. The legislature sets up a task force to look at how we resolve these. They bring them to the Consumer Protection Committee. The industry says, oh, no, that's a problem. The industry gets itself together and says, we don't like these bills, and tries to work something out, and that we're trying to have a battle here between the committee protecting the consumer and the industry protecting itself. And I want to say that's not the situation in any kind of way. You have to understand that for the industry, consumer protection is in our self-interest, as Jessica has just told you. We want strong consumer protection laws because it helps us, those who are legitimate contractors. That being said, trying to work out the details of the best way to make this consumer protection laws actually work is something that we have some technical knowledge, and our industry members have technical knowledge, and we work on this using that and the professionals in your state agencies to make something that works. And that's where our concern is. So we're not trying to find a balance that makes us not to have so much regulation against this. We're trying to do something that will be of common interest to both this committee and the consumers and the industry. And I think that those interests are not conflicting. They're identical.
Questions from the committee? Well, I appreciate your testimony. Certainly, this committee is interested in solutions that work for the industry and the consumers. So, anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2659? Is this about mobile homes?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner, here on behalf of Manufactured Housing Association. Just a quick comment. I echo what Mr. Corey said. And, you know, just the next page over, after the bankruptcy, a person could be suspended, license denied, or revoked if he engaged in any financial matter that demonstrates wrongdoing. Now, I'm not, you know, that kind of open-ended. I know my son and I have been discussing allowances lately. I assume that he would, well, he may have a credible argument that my underpayment of his allowance, you see my point, and it's... So I think that the language needs to be drawn more carefully to really focus in and give on wrongdoers and give notice to people of what is wrongful conduct. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions and would be happy to. We're interested in participating in any work groups that deal with this, and that will conclude what I have to say.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Miner?
Thank you.
Thank you. No further comments from the committee or the public. It is our intention to keep looking at these bills, and hopefully folks will let us know what their issues and hopefully what their solutions to these task force recommendations are, because I think it's still in the interest of the state, the industry, and the consumer to come up with some implementation on at least some of the aspects of these recommendations. I think they all share some merits, and it's trying to decide whether these merits are going to fit and be practical in the real world and accomplish something is the task of this committee. And we will be rehearing these bills someday soon. So I appreciate everybody's interest and appreciate your attendance today. No further comments from the committee. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2659 and adjourn the committee on consumer protection. Thank you.
It's a virtual public record anyway.